Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 114 featuring Eric Durst. Sean, Eric Durst is a very important person. Do you know that?
Yes, I do.
You do, yes. And he is, I'm going to call him part of our series of old school VFX guys. People have been around for a long time and we have a lot to learn from them, which is great to have them on this podcast and be able to learn from a lot of the things they have. So Eric, he comes from way back when he was over at CalArts and other places. He did work on Tron, the original Tron, and was one of the animators on that, and really did some amazing work, obviously, there. Did a lot of work in the early days of CG and CG and commercials, and did some really interesting work there. One of the most interesting stories, I think, is hearing how they used to composite back then and how unbelievably expensive and time-consuming it was. It used to be like something like $4,000 an hour or something insane. And you had very little time, and there was no undoing. It was really, really a tough thing. So just hearing some of those stories. But one of the things that is really cool to hear about from Eric is the way that he has worked on some really big movies in terms of the size of the visual effects and how he plans that when you're on set. Well, so when you have an enormous green screen behind people, how do you plan for that? How do you know what to do? Where do you go? How do you pre-visualize? And when do you use green screen? When do you use blue screen? Why do you make those choices? All these different things. So it was really great conversation. I think anyone who listens to this can learn a lot from someone like Eric. So it was really great to have him on. Okay, but Sean, we have some news for now. So why don't you go ahead and tell us some of the things that are going on?
Well, there's been a couple releases recently. Mm-hmm. The big one is V-Ray 3 for SketchUp.
V-Ray for SketchUp, very popular product.
Very, very popular.
We're doing a webinar on that, right?
Yeah, we are. We'd be doing a webinar. We had the original date was Tuesday, and all those webinar sessions filled up. So we just added Wednesday, March 22nd. You can register online. Just go to chaosgroup.com, go to SketchUp, and at the top it says register for webinar.
Okay, so the 21st is full, which is Tuesday. So Wednesday, which is this week,
yes,
will be the second one on the 22nd. So there's still some spaces available there.
Yes.
Hopefully they will be available when the podcast comes out. And then there's, for those of you who want to know about some of the cool things that are going on, one of the coolest things I think that's going on the SketchUp side of things, and I think it's going to be in Revit too, or may already be in Revit, is this idea of Swarm. Which is an evolution of distributed rendering. So I did a blog post about it. So go check out the blog post at labs.chaosgroup.com and check out the thing I did about Swarm, because I think it's really going to be very of big interest to people. And then there's another product. What's the other release we have?
Phoenix 3 for Maya.
Phoenix 3 for Maya. Okay, so Phoenix, if for those of you who may not know, I'm sure a lot of you do, but if you don't know, is our fluid simulator, and it is very, very robust and gotten a really, really friendly or user-friendly this version. There's a lot of new things on. There's a new flip solver. There's also something that's really great for people who just want to work in it really fast. There's some quick presets where you can just add a fire, add an explosion, et cetera. And the presets are all set up for you so you don't have to go through all the rigmarole of setting up a fluid simulator, which is a little bit tough sometimes. And also, it's got a much faster volume rendering and a bunch of other things. So really exciting stuff, right, Sean?
Yeah.
All right. And we'll have more to announce as we go along. We want to make sure that you guys follow us on social. Sean, as you know, you will remind us that we do have a Facebook page, right?
Yes, we are on Facebook.
Right. So what is our Facebook?
CG Garage Podcast.
Yeah. All one word. So facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, all one word. Make sure you follow us there. Check things out. We do put a lot more news than just whatever the latest podcast is. There's stuff that goes up there all the time, mm-hmm. including teasers of other podcasts that are maybe coming up. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And, of course, you can also follow us, the regular Chaos Group on Facebook. You can follow Chaos Group Labs on Twitter, which is CG_Labs. and make sure you can let us know ideas you have there. Of course, you can always go to labs.chaoscoop.com and leave comments there. And we'd love to hear from you. Last thing is make sure and rate us on iTunes. People love to hear about our thoughts there. So that's always very useful for us. And hopefully you guys have been enjoying this podcast for a little over 2 years. So it would be great to hear back from you guys. All right, guys. Thank you. Hope you enjoy this podcast.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Christian told me. I guess. When did you run into Christian? I guess when he was in town.
Yeah, I ran into Christian when he was in town.
Uh huh.
And we had met each other, gosh, maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, or something. We'd seen each other. We'd tried to get together a number of times, and I'm out of the country so often that we didn't hook up, and then it just sort of synced up.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah. What are you doing out of the country all the time?
doing shows.
Yeah.
Because most of the stuff is out of the country. And I was in Australia for 2.5 years, and I was in Europe now for many months.
Yes.
And it's just the way it is. Unfortunately, it's part of the deal, where whether it's production or now production and usually post-production.
Right.
So it's increasingly longer periods of time.
Right.
Which is unfortunate for us in LA.
Yeah.
But that's the way it is at the moment.
But okay, so you've actually spent a lot of time on set, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's something I want to get into with you at some point, because I think a lot of people could learn about. I mean, I've seen your reel, obviously, and there's a lot of stuff of planning on set and sort of understanding that, which I think would be beneficial for people to know about. But let's start a little bit about with your background. You've been doing this for a very long time, right?
Been doing it for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess you could say I was sort of born in this arena, not visual effects, but in the art field. My dad was a painter, and he I sort of grew up in a very creative background. My dad was head of an art department in Arkansas, and had a beautiful art center that was built when he was there. It was really the first art center in America, if people can wrap their heads around it, meaning that it's a building that housed all the arts, architecture, dance, theater, sculpture, everything, music, everything was at one, in one. And it was sort of built on the Bauhaus idea.
Oh, okay.
And beautifully designed by Ed Stone, who did the Kennedy Center and so forth, who was also a local architect, or he'd grown up in the same small town in Arkansas that I grew up in. So, when I grew up, I was around all the arts,
right?
Which was interesting and also confusing, because I didn't really know which one to get into.
There was a lot of them.
A lot of them.
Right.
So I dabbled in all those as I was growing up. And one evening, actually, when I was in architecture school at the University of Arkansas, I saw a television show about CalArts.
Ah, okay.
And I saw it, and it was like, oh, wow, that's great. That's just like the art center here, but in California. And I had been to California. I love California. And I always wanted to move there. So I ended up going to CalArts.
But you were already in architecture school at the time.
I was in architecture school, deciding that really wasn't for me. It was a great background. And of course, it is a background for a lot of people in visual effects, because it's a the process of construction, visual construction, which becomes something real. So it's a discipline that a lot of people have. Certainly, production designers.
It's amazing how many people on this podcast have an architecture background. It's almost 50% in some cases. It's incredible.
That's interesting.
With just some touches of it, some ways, or people like me who I was an architect and left the field completely.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyway, so you went to CalArts, which is a great, great school.
Went to CalArts in early days when you could, and I was very fortunate at that point. I had started as I wanted to get in any way I could. So I decided I wanted to be a painter, but I wasn't quite a painter. And then through a number of circumstances, I got in the photography department.
Oh, okay.
So because I had taken pictures and had done all that. So I started the first day as a photographer. Mm-hmm. And that evening, I met some people who were in the animation department.
Uh-huh.
And the next day, walked into the animation room.
Uh-huh.
And Jules Engel, who was a very famous director of that, walked up to me and said, hi. And I said, oh, this is really interesting. So he went over, got a large stack of paper, put it in front of me, uh-huh. and a pencil, and he said, make a film.
Wow.
And that's how it started.
Okay.
And it was the days where you could walk in because there weren't a lot of people in that department, if you can believe it.
Right.
This is in the early 70s. So uh-huh. Now it's completely different.
Right.
And it's the world-class animation department in the world.
Probably. And very competitive.
Right. Very competitive. So I just was at the right place at the right time.
Uh-huh.
And Jules became my mentor, and that's how I got into animation.
Uh-huh.
And photography became less and less and less, although I was always interested in it, but I loved animation, and that's mm-hmm. really how I started.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so when you left CalArts, did you get a job as an animator from there, or?
I tried. I remember having a great, and actually it wasn't a great meeting, at Hanna-Barbera.
Uh-huh.
And showing them my student independent films, mm-hmm. and they were less than impressed.
Okay.
And I realized that the skill sets that I was building weren't necessarily in that arena.
Okay.
But I was always interested in the commercial aspect of it, or how to make a living doing what I love to do.
Sure.
So I ended up moving to New York. Before that, I got a number of grants. I was fortunate in that case. I got an AFI grant.
Mm-hmm.
I got a National Endowment grant. I got a lot of different grants to sort of keep me going and do independent animation for a number of years.
Okay.
And then I lived in New York and became acquainted with the commercial area, or doing commercials, because mm-hmm. it's such a big part of New York City.
Right.
And spent 1 year basically doing cold calling for an agency, learning what the Red Book was, and which is the directory of all the advertising agencies in the country, and which was a very fortunate event.
Okay.
Because years later, I decided that New York was a great city to be in, but it wasn't really a film town.
Right.
At that point, it's different.
Much
now.
More Madison Avenue.
Much more Madison Avenue and
right.
financial.
Right.
So I moved to California.
Mm-hmm.
Was very fortunate because I knew somebody who was at the Disney studio. And this is, again, not the way things ever really happened, but fortunately it happened for me, mm-hmm. where I walked in and got a job at the Disney studio sort of in the first week mm-hmm. on movie Tron.
Oh, right.
And that was the first time, as you know, because you've right. talked to Richard Taylor and other people.
Yeah.
The first time that they sort of opened the gates of the Disney studio to the outsiders.
Right. Okay. And because that was not traditional animation. It was a very different kind of animation, right?
Very different.
Right.
Well, yes and no. We okay. always call it the world's first handmade computer animated film.
Okay.
Because it really was.
Sure.
And everything was shot on the downshooter. It was in Codalis. It was all put together in a very handmade way.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of the structures, the line drawings and so forth were created
on a computer.
On a computer.
Right. But it was still basically shot cell by cell. Right?
Absolutely.
And so is that the portion that you were working on? What part of it were you working on at that time?
I was doing, I was an assistant animator to uh-huh. Barry Cook, who's actually a great animation director.
Uh-huh.
And he was, we were doing the frisbee throws, I guess.
Oh, the disc battle.
Disc battle and so forth. So I was doing effects animation, uh-huh. hand-drawn effects animation.
Okay.
So not simulations, but hand-drawn simulations, like that.
Yeah, that took place for a long time. I was just talking about it with someone else. They were, how people used to be the hand-drawn lightning people, right? Mm-hmm. Like they would draw lightning bolts by hand.
Absolutely.
And so that's basically what a lot of people did. You know, you didn't have simulators to do that.
No.
The computer power did not have the capability of doing that. You have to use your brain.
Right, which is a good discipline.
Yeah,
a great discipline. And actually, at CalArts, from my understanding, is they teach hand animation. I mean, that is the background of everything.
Yeah.
Because you have to internalize it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's really a skill that is lost. A lot of people have lost it because it's all computer driven and computer intelligence.
Yes, yes and no. I think there's definitely some benefits to it, to doing things on a computer that help.
Sure, of course.
But I think the animation portion of it is, or hand animation, as you were saying, is critical, because that's how we convey emotion or feeling a lot better. Right. That it's hard to simulate feeling and emotion.
Right.
We know it when we feel it, I think. So it's interesting.
And you also, when you're creating it.
Yeah, when you're creating it, exactly.
Right, you feel it.
You feel it.
And it's a very visceral feeling when it's coming from you into your hand, into your drawing,
right,
and so forth. And just that can translate into what you're doing on the computer as well, because you feel it. It's like, I call it a parallel language.
Uh-huh.
I feel like visual effects is a parallel language.
Okay.
As a supervisor, you're always speaking parallel, which means you speak technically and very, very specifically about things,
yep,
at the same time, emotionally.
Yes.
So you can do something, you have to be very specific in what your brief is,
mm-hmm,
but then at the same time, you feel it.
Right. Because you have to say, okay, everything I just said, how does that serve the vision in some way? Right?
Right.
And how does the vision benefit from all of this stuff?
Right.
Yeah, it's true. It's very, very true. It's a very – visual effects is a very interesting way to do that. And I don't know. You were sort of at the – I guess really at the forefront of computer graphics in that area, because obviously Tron 1982, right?
Right.
That was the beginning of all that. So you must have seen how that portion of things sort of evolved in terms of animation. So
right,
what happened after that, that you could notice the changes that were going on?
Well, I think it's the transition from analog to digital,
mm-hmm,
but also it's from hand drawn to computer driven or assisted and then driven.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of this handoff between one and the other.
Okay.
So really what I saw is that there was a lot of pain between one and the other.
Mm-hmm.
There were some transition moments which were difficult. Visual effects used to be very difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it isn't now.
Sure.
But you were always walking around with a knot in your stomach because you were shooting blind.
Right.
On an optical printer or even on a down shooter.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in Tron, and then later on I went to do motion graphics for a number of years, and then I ended up working at DreamQuest
Images,
which was just down the street here.
Yeah.
And the reason I got that job was because I understood what the Red Book was, the experience I had in New York City.
Okay.
Because
how did that work?
Well, that was the forefront of having visual effects in commercials.
Ah, okay. Yes, of course.
And at that point, it's hard to believe now, but there were very few, if any, really visual effects in commercials, because it was just too difficult. The timeline was too fast.
Yep.
And everything was optically driven.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very fortunate time to be there because the competition was low. In other words, there were only a couple of companies that were doing visual effects. There's Robert Abel.
Mm-hmm.
There was DreamQuest at that point. We were just starting because mm-hmm. a man walked in and just gave us like five national commercials in one day.
Can you give people a bit of a history of DreamQuest? Because we've mentioned it a
sure.
couple of times on the podcast,
okay.
and I know the history, but it would be great for people to tell where did that company come from?
That started from really Doug Trumbull's,
okay,
and a lot of the people like Scott Squires and Hoyt Yateman and Rocco Geoffrey and mm-hmm. and Bob and Tom Hollister mm-hmm. and Fred Aguchi, where they were the six owners.
Okay.
And like a lot of companies, that and Apogee as well,
mm-hmm.
usually it was a lot of people doing visual effects in a larger company
mm-hmm.
and at night looking at each other and saying, hey, let's do it ourselves.
Right.
And okay. so you have this group of artists who come together and form a company.
Okay.
And that's very much in the mold of what happened at DreamQuest.
Okay.
And they had done a number of features, and when I came in, which was mid-80s, mm-hmm. This is when this transition happened in commercials, when people were getting interested in the visual effects part of it.
Right.
And so there was a guy who, Buddy Kahn, who was sort of very strong-willed guy mm-hmm. in New York City, who had a number of commercials from BBDO, which is a large agency in New York City. There was a G commercial, I think three Dodge commercials. There was some other things like that. And just sort of walked in the door and said, I have, you know, $2 million of commercials, and would you guys like to do them? Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, sure, why not?
Okay.
But really didn't know how to do them.
Sure.
Because it was just a new world. And I had started actually introduced to them because they were doing one of these Dodge commercials. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine asked me to come and do some animation with them. And so it was, we were up in an attic doing this animation on the commercials myself. Scott Squires was up there doing his computer programming, and Linda Wyman was there too.
Okay.
Linda, if you know.
I don't know.
Linda's lynda.com, if you
know. Oh, right, of course.
Yeah. So she went later on to do that. And so anyway, all three of us were sort of in this attic animating Dodge commercials. And that's how I sort of got introduced to the world. Mm-hmm. And later on, they realized they needed an executive director mm-hmm. or executive producer to sort of run their commercial division, because I knew the Red Book. I knew how to reach ad agencies and had some vague knowledge of commercials. I got that position. So I started the commercial division there.
Oh, nice.
To do that.
And you just started cold calling people, said you have...
Well, it was... We didn't really have to call people.
It was starting to become organic.
Came to us. Right? Yeah. It was really, I think at that point it was, as I said, Robert Abel, Bob Greenberg in New York, mm-hmm. the Greenberg Company, mm-hmm. and Paraxis, I think, was doing commercials, and DreamQuest. We were the only companies really in the country doing television commercials.
Okay.
And that was before Apogee or ILM or any of those had opened their commercial division and so forth. So it was really at the beginning of those.
Gotcha.
And what was interesting about it was, fortunate for me, was I saw myself as a director and wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. So I was able to like look at a storyboard and say, great, I'll direct this one.
Okay.
So I got to direct a Dodge commercial, a Diet Pepsi commercial and so forth. And that's sort of how I began.
Well, that's interesting, because obviously then the thing is that making that transition of seeing a storyboard and saying, how am I going to make this happen, right? And you had, that was probably the beginning of how you are able to envision visual effects down the line, right? So that's probably what helped you be, you know, as prolific as you are on set, right? Because I've seen a lot your reel, which is great. But there was a huge amount of blue screens and stuff that you were planning. So I was like, we just need this portion. And then I know I can envision in my mind how I'm going to fill in the rest of it and how it all coordinates. So after you were at DreamQuest obviously didn't stay around for too long, and you started getting more into features, right? So how did that transition
happen? Well, I went I was asked to because I was doing commercials at that point.
Right.
And what was interesting about it is that, and something that people may not know about, but it makes sense, is that really the first electronic compositing was in commercials, basically because the resolution was lower.
Right.
And so a lot of visual effects supervisors, myself, John Dykstra, a lot of other people, mm-hmm. Were doing commercials.
Right.
People who were major feature people mm-hmm. were doing commercials. And so that's where we were able to work at the first CIS and the garage in on Cahuenga and mm-hmm. so forth, and really just do that world. Mm-hmm. So I was asked if I wanted to leave DreamQuest and join Apogee.
Okay.
And I was at Apogee the last year that they were in existence mm-hmm. with John Dykstra and Trip Groover, who was also a director there. Mm-hmm. So we were the three commercial guys.
Right.
And
what were you compositing on back then?
Well, we were compositing on tape.
So, on tape, right.
Yeah, so it was basically what you would do. CIS was really the first company to do pin registered transfers.
Okay.
Right? So CIS was a company that was about maybe four of these small rooms.
Okay.
And it was behind a house on Cahuenga.
Okay.
And you would go back there. They had a pin registered camera. Mm-hmm. And there was Joe Matza, who ran the company, who really the founder of CIS. Mm-hmm. And then Don Lee and Price Pethel, mm-hmm. who were the compositors, and Joni Jacobson, who is Pixamondo right now,
right,
executive producer. She was the first paint box artist.
Oh, okay.
And that was the company. So you go there, you would shoot your commercial, mm-hmm. they would pin register it, mm-hmm. and then you go up to North Hollywood mm-hmm. to laser edit.
Okay.
And Arden Reinu, who is this fantastic compositor, mm-hmm. you put everything on 1-inch tape or sometimes 2-inch tape in the earlier right. days, and you would take it and you'd string up to 12 machines together at an enormous burn rate of money,
okay,
$3,000 to $4,000 an hour, and you would start putting your project together and
layer it
all, layer. Early keyers, early mixers, ADOs to move things wow. around and so forth, and having a vague idea that you knew what you were doing, that everything lined up, but really no way to know until you got there.
Right.
And you would spend anywhere from 10 to 48 hours, sometimes longer, mm-hmm. On a single session.
Right.
You'd spend 2, sometimes 3 days without anyone sleeping and doing
this. I'm sure the setup was long and you didn't want to have to set it up again, right? So you had to take that time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was analog tape. So.
Right.
So you really didn't have the disc, it wasn't in digital format.
Right.
So you really couldn't go back and do layers. So you had to mathematically figure it out. And in a way, it was a great discipline mm-hmm. because you were able to build things in your mind, mm-hmm. or you had to build things in your mind.
Right.
And you had to figure out, okay, I have 12 different pieces that go together. Mm-hmm. And if I record it down onto a master and then I do one layer on top of that, mm-hmm. that's about all I'll get before it starts to fall apart.
Okay.
It's like Xeroxing a Xerox.
Right,
a Xerox,
right, right.
A Xerox.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing.
Right.
So you had to figure out the most efficient way of doing things.
Yep.
And then in the end, 50 hours later and $100,000 over budget,
right.
you would end up blurry-eyed with your master.
Right.
And there it was. And that's how it worked. And wow. everyone did that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So this was before Henry's or any of that stuff,
oh, yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And then I remember once CIS got the first Abacus. So it was the first disc recorder. At that point, I think you get 10 seconds.
Oh, wow.
Which meant 10 seconds of layering or 10 seconds of a master. So 10 seconds total.
Right.
So you had to figure out what
could fit in there.
What could fit in there.
Okay.
And time was at a max. It was just a premium.
Right.
Because everyone was trying to get in there. And every commercial now wanted that. The appetite was exponential at that point.
Okay.
As it still is.
Right.
And so I remember doing a commercial with Price once. We had 4 hours. He said, I can give you 4 hours. That's all I can do. Uh-huh. And after the 4 hours, we weren't finished. Mm-hmm. And he said, we got to go. And so we just pushed the
done button.
Delete.
Oh, delete.
And that was it. We hadn't finished.
Oh, wow.
And we had to come back later.
Wow.
And of course, more money was burned.
Yeah.
So it was a tricky time.
So you had to figure out how to get it done in 4 hours.
But
it's almost like being on set, right?
Exactly. And it sort of leads to your initial question was mm-hmm. how... what thinking methods do you have to sort of pre-visualize or pre-imagine what things are going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, it's more forgiving now because you can do a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And you can erase backgrounds and you can do things. I mean, early days, you couldn't get rid of dust or anything. I mean,
right.
it was absolutely zero forgiveness.
Right.
And the forgiveness was in the viewer's eye because mm-hmm. things were so novel that things that look horrible now were fantastic then.
Right.
So that was the only buffer that you
yep.
had. But I guess now it's you have to, you know, like anything, you want to understand what the end result's going to be, and then you sort of retrofit and work backwards from there
sure.
and figure out what you need and also how little you need
right.
because everything costs money,
mm-hmm.
not only in construction costs of a set, but also time. And then mm-hmm. you have to balance out, is it better to have the set, let's say, 3/4 built so the actors feel comfortable mm-hmm. knowing that you're going to have to rotto out everybody and replace everything?
Right.
Or is it better to have a completely blue set where the actors are lost? Mm-hmm. Or is it good to have, what are those key things to have in the set so you get the best of both? So you don't have so much to roto out. You know, you're going to replace most of the background anyway.
Sure.
But there's enough that the actor feels comfortable with. So having a background in theater and knowing what that's like and directing commercials and actors for so long, you have a real responsibility to the actor, knowing that if you don't get the performance, no matter what you do, is not going to make it work. So you have to get their performance, even in even if you have to sacrifice some of the effects ease.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting process. I've mentioned this before. I used to work in commercials as well, and I was a VFX supervisor there. One of my favorite parts of a commercial is actually the bidding process, because that's the part where you take whatever the idea is and you have to come up with a methodology of how it's going to work. That's the most efficient, because the thing is, right, as I'm sure you know, they'll come up to you and they'll say, we want to do this. And you're not going to go, all right, how am I going to make it so it's going to be the most amazing thing and it's going to cost? Because there is a budget. There's a budget.
Right.
And so you have to come in within that budget and creatively. And then the people that are working with you, if you pull off something really amazing and creative, they're going to come back to you. So the budget's going to be the budget. You're going to have to fit it in some way or another. So I always loved that process because oftentimes what I'd do is I'd say, okay, we'd have a commercial as an example, and I didn't have an idea. And the idea was, well, the way it's described in the script or the treatment or whatever, it's usually way over the price of what they can afford, right? So what I love to do is saying, okay, here's what it would cost to actually do that the way you described it, but then talk to the director or the agency or whoever and says, let's come up with an idea that could possibly evolve this. And sometimes those restrictions, like a budget, can come up with better ideas once you talk through it.
Absolutely.
A lot of times is talking people out of doing visual effects in some cases,
right?
And finding other ways of doing things. So I've always loved that process. And then to me, it's the beginning of the relationship you have with whoever you're doing the creative work with.
Right. So you bring up two interesting points. One is limits can be, within reason, limits can be a very good thing.
Yes.
Because, okay, Chris, you have 2 hours to do X.
Right.
Or we have 30 minutes to do this podcast.
Right.
So let's be the most efficient and really get going with it. So there's that kind of limit, which is a very good thing, a discipline that you have to bring to it.
Yep.
And then also you bring up another point about how do you work with clients or other people who come to you to solve their problems.
Sure.
And I see this missed a lot in terms of presentation to either artists or just people in general, is that someone, if you come to me and ask me to do your storyboard, I have to answer that exactly the way you want it. So I have to tell you it's going to cost this much money to do exactly what you want. I have to acknowledge and respect what you're doing. But also, on top of that, I need to have a solution.
Right.
So if you're $50,000 or $500,000 over, I need, the real responsibility is to acknowledge exactly what you've asked for, but also give you an alternative which is as good, if not better, than that. For within the parameters.
Right.
And that is the real trick.
Yes. And I often find that when the creative people are willing to listen to the fact that, hey, we need to come up with another solution to save budget, oftentimes when they work with you, sometimes the solution you come up with is better than the original idea.
Right.
It often is, more than often.
Or it sparks a conversation.
Right.
So whatever you pitch back, it may not be what they're considering, but they love the fact that you did that.
Yes.
So now there's a conversation.
Yep.
And then you start talking about it, and then because you have a relationship now, and then you work it out.
Yep.
And so the original board sort of goes by the wayside, and then something new is brewed up. And that's really the key to working with anybody in this business is understanding that principle.
And I think what the end result that I was, you know, sort of expressed to executive producers who I work with, who are sort of people who line up the relationship or the bid, is I'm starting a relationship with this person mm-hmm. before we've even won the bid.
Right.
So they're going to favor us in a lot of ways, even though we may not necessarily be the cheapest, right? They're not going to go, we'll just go with the cheapest, because they may not necessarily do that. They've already started a relationship with me. And so I'm able to say, it's like, you know, I trust what this guy's saying because I've had a conversation with it. So I think it's a key thing is having the creative discussion and making that part of it.
It reminds me of something that happens to me, and I'm sure yourself, is like a lot of younger people or people who want to get in the business come and say, what do I need to do to learn how to do it?
Right.
And one of the pieces of advice I say, if you get a meeting with somebody, first of all, you probably have technical skills that are on par or able to get you that meeting to begin with. So don't worry about that. If you're on a movie, all they're doing is looking at you and saying, can I hang out with this person for the next year?
Right.
That's really what the meeting is about.
Yeah.
And if you address that, even if you're not the best person, they will forgive you for that.
Right.
Because they like you, or they want to hang out with you, or you can do it. You can be the most genius person in the world, and if you're a pain in the ass, it's like, no, thank you.
Yeah, it's like saying, looking at a person, it's like, can I be on a canoe trip with that person, right?
Right, the same thing, or can I go to war with them, or whatever. Can I be on this plane ride with them?
Yeah.
And that's really the key to a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And knowledge and everything is obviously important and necessary and all that, but that's really sort of the magic ingredient.
I find it very fascinating, especially on set, because the movie making process, or you know, shooting things or being on set, this is a group of people that have to work like a fine oiled machine constantly. And it's a creative process, and it's one of the only ones where I feel like I've worked in architecture where you work with different groups, et cetera, but it's much more background. It's much more like post effects, where an animator can just be on his own doing his own animation thing, and you go check on and I'm like once or twice a day or whatever. But on set, you have to constantly communicate. It's like operating a submarine or something, right?
Right.
And if you fall apart, then it's a problem, you know?
Right.
So I think that that's really amazing, the amount of – and the respect that people have for each other on set, you know, from the grips to the electricians to the AD to the actors and all those guys, just sort of getting together and being part of that process. I think it's important.
The dynamics of a set – are as fascinating as making the movie, if not often more so.
Sure.
And I really love that. And it's interesting just what you're talking about and seeing that. And because you're the visual effects person, everything sort of defaults to you. When the set burns down or when something isn't right, they look at you.
Yes.
And you have to think on your feet and say the thumbs up or thumbs down or whatever. And so you have to understand what it costs, what an hour of time costs.
Right.
And all that. But really, when you get onto a movie, one of the things that you must do is meet every person in every department or on the heads of all the departments and all the others, because it's just this fabric of all these different people who come together and form what the movie is.
Sure.
And those relationships are pivotal.
Yeah.
And when you go to a set, the respect you get and respect you give others is like a quiet respect. It's not like a respect where you come in and you start barking orders and stuff.
Right.
You can't be that.
Right.
There's too much involved and, too much focus that happens.
Sure.
So you build your respect by, you know, talking to them, meeting with them, throwing around ideas, getting those conversations going.
Sure.
And then there's a trust that's built up between everybody, because you know you're in this together.
Right.
And oftentimes, whatever is designed is oftentimes not what happens on the set. Once you get there, things change. it's the set is different, the conditions are different, whatever it is, the actor doesn't want to do it that way, right, or the there's a better camera angle or so forth.
Right.
So you're always having to pay attention and understand what the impact is, mm-hmm, and know what you can and can't do. That's why as a supervisor, you need to know what the money is also. You need, mm-hmm, to be familiar with the budget.
Yep.
You don't necessarily have to get into the weeds of all the different details about the money, but you have to have a good gut feeling of what it costs.
Right.
So if you look at a set that, or usually a camera that doesn't, the blue screen or green screen you set up is now over on the right because the camera is now looking, right, down on the set,
right,
and you have to replace something. Well, is it better to just sit back for an hour and have the screen come in and rebuild it, mm-hmm, or do you just shoot it and roto it out? Is that going to look right? Is the hair going to, is it too fine to really be able to do that? Do you,
right,
bring a smaller screen? How do you do that? And you have to know in an instant what that answer is, because,
right,
time is super money on a movie where you're spending $250,000 a day,
right,
divided by 10 hours. That's, what is it, $25,000,
yeah,
an hour?
Right.
So it's, a lot of money, $500,
yeah,
a minute.
Yeah.
So everything cost. And so your thinking process is like, well, let me think for a while. Okay, that was $500.
That's, right,
$1,000.
Right.
And it all adds up. Not that that's money that you got as a visual effects person, but it's money overall.
Right.
And so your ability to respond quickly and know solution is,
right,
is important. Sometimes you have to make those decisions without really knowing if they're right or not.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just from a gut.
Right.
Sometimes you say, well, we'll do it this way. And then sometimes you're halfway into it and it's like, maybe,
right,
we should have done it the other way.
Right.
And then it's like, is it that bad we have to change it? Or the crew is already going in this one direction.
Yeah, usually, because if you change a schedule, you could be off by a lot.
Change, right, everything. It confuses people and then it,
right,
just, it ripples. So all those dynamics are always in play all the time.
Right.
And in the most innocent of situations, it can unfold.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be alert all the time, even though it seems like nothing is going on.
Right.
Because
it's very hard because you have to make decisions in a matter of minutes that's going to affect months of work down,
right,
the line.
Right.
And you don't know whether that's going to be, how that time is going to be used. It's like, okay, like you said, $500 a minute in terms of you thinking about things, right?
So, right. Is it $5,000? I'm not sure.
It's pretty high. If it's $25,000 an hour, so it's pretty high. But
okay,
it's,
yeah,
a lot of money.
Yeah.
Trying to think about it, it's like, okay, what am I going to do? I've always felt the pressure of that, and sometimes being on the other side when you're in post and it's like, oh my God, why did they shoot it this way?
Right.
It's like, well, you weren't on set that day and you,
right,
don't know the repercussions. And yes, it looks like it's going to be a lot of unnecessary work,
mm-hmm,
but it was a very hard decision to make, right?
Yeah.
So how do you plan things? Like if you get a script, and I looked at some of the work you've done, obviously on some amazing movies like Snowpiercer and stuff was, mm-hmm, really great. There's massive amounts of green screen on those, on those,
right,
things. And you had to think about it, like how do you plan that? What's the process? Do you have a team, and how's your pre-production and your pre-viz? How do you do all of that stuff?
Well, I'm a big fan of pre-viz, just,
right,
to have that. If not a fan, and sometimes not a fan, because sometimes it can get, everyone goes too specific on a,
yes,
on pre-viz, and it flattens everything out.
Yep.
But at least it allows you to wrap your head around things.
Mm-hmm.
So any tools like that allow you, enable you to think about it, help,
mm-hmm,
whether it's previs or illustrations or just, looking at other reference or anything like that. You,
mm-hmm,
you want to try to visit as many similar situations as possible,
mm-hmm,
especially if they're unfamiliar,
mm-hmm,
and learn all that you can.
Okay.
And so that, I think, helps. Usually you have less time than you would like to,
sure,
do that. So you have to go on, previous knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But art department is always a great resource.
Okay.
Especially on a feature where,
right,
you have artists who have figured out in great detail what the sets are and what they have, and they can give you a SketchUp model or something. At least on a very simple level, you can sort of pre-visualize what you think the angles are going to be and so forth, and what the problems are going to be. Because you're always asked, like, art department is always under budget restrictions, and they would love to build everything, but they can only build like a table instead of like this whole mansion.
Right.
So they always ask you, what, how much you're going to build and how much you aren't going to build. So the pre-visualization process really happens usually with the art department and the sets that they're building.
Okay.
So that sort of sets up the environment that you're going to be in.
Right.
And then lighting, of course, is very important. So when you get with the DP, you can figure out the lighting. And they're always interested, especially if it's a whole green room, what that's going to be like, because they need to light it for that end result, not necessarily for the green room.
Right.
So that, and if you don't get the lighting right, you'll never get it right.
Yeah.
It'll always look bad. And
right.
It's not your
fault.
It won't look
composite.
But it is your fault, because people will say it's your fault.
Right.
But it's not. But, but it's just, you can't say that.
Yeah.
So I guess you think about things in lots of levels. It's not like you sit down and you go read a book and do it isolated. In an isolated format, you have a lot of conversations with a lot of people because what they're thinking about in terms of the sets, in terms of the costumes, in terms of the camera lighting and so forth affect what your decisions are usually. And you can give them an idea of like, we're going to put a blue screen here and we're going to, put all the rest in the background. That's sort of the simple part.
Okay.
But the most difficult part is really figuring out how those are going to integrate. And what kind of lighting it's going to be to get you there.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Absolutely. Do you feel that, I mean, obviously you've been doing this for a long time. Do you feel that the people on set have become better at understanding the language of visual effects, understanding the decisions they make? Do you feel, obviously before, I think sometimes they just had a hard time lighting for invisible characters or sets that weren't there. Do you think that they understand more, like the decisions they're making is actually going to benefit the visual effects?
Sure. I think it's better. I mean, everyone's gotten more fluent in this.
Sure.
But there's still this phenomena, which I, even to this day, is amazing. You can have the most world-class crew, and then you get like a small little blue screen that comes out. That's a postage stamp, and everyone goes really stupid. Everyone sort of like, oh, it's a visual effects shot, and they sort of like stand back.
Oh, really?
So I find that the case, not all the time, but I find that to be an interesting phenomenon.
Right. Just because something is going to be put in later, they don't.
Yeah, and you get things like, let's say, this table we're looking at, we have to get rid of it. You know, I have to do the background. So they say, well, we'll just paint it green. Well, that doesn't make it go away. It doesn't make the background that it's obstructing appear.
Right. Green stuff is for behind.
Yes, exactly. But you always get that all the time. Should we paint it green? Should we do this? No, it doesn't matter.
Right. In fact, it's going to make it worse.
It's going to make it worse sometimes because it's going to spill green light on you.
Yes, exactly.
So, no, just leave it the way it is. We'll figure it out. You know, we'll paint it out.
Right.
But that kind of thinking, people haven't got to that point yet.
Right.
But I think in terms of the understanding, at least it's something that people see the end result. And oftentimes they see situations that were not planned or something that was just really messed up. In the end, it looks great. So they figure, sometimes they figure, well, it doesn't matter. But it really does matter. It always matters.
They don't know how much work went into making that.
Right. And it always makes it better. So that's why the lighting has to be right, all this kind of stuff. And everyone's under enormous pressure with time and just the money and everything like that. And everything is getting jammed up into more shots and more setups in smaller days, or the same days, but more, being pushed in. So there's a lot of pressure to a light in more a general way, or not be as specific and not spend 2 hours lighting something because you have 12 setups that day. You have to do one every 45 minutes. So so that kind of thing has to be thought about, and you have to respect that also and know when it's really critical and when it isn't. And I think one of the most primary things that you need to know as a supervisor is what's really important, what's sort of important, and what isn't important.
Right.
And what seems like massively important sometimes isn't.
Right.
And what seemingly isn't important is massively important.
Right.
Like lighting and a certain shadow and something like mm-hmm. that you really can't fake in any kind of
right.
legitimate way. And so you have to use your bullets in the right way. So you okay. have to, like, when you say, okay, we need to spend 30 minutes relighting this scene mm-hmm. because it's important. When you say that, you don't do it all the time. It's not like shouting fire all the time.
Yeah, it's like a certain amount of get out of jail free cards.
Right? Yeah, they say, okay, Eric or Chris right. says it's important, so
right.
We've got to do it.
Right.
So then you do it. So you have to respect everyone's time mm-hmm. and know when to use those get out of jail cards.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting process and the dynamic between the balance of all those things. You mentioned earlier the challenges that you see with actors and when the set is too green or too blue. Right. By the way, explain to people. People may be curious to know what are the choices people make between doing a green screen or a blue screen?
Well, it usually has to do with a number of things. I did a movie called Gods of Egypt, which was in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And it was a golden film. Now, there was a lot of gold around.
So the color of the film.
Yeah, a lot of yellow, mm-hmm. which doesn't work with green very well.
Right.
And so
it'll dingy it, right?
You dingy it and sometimes confuse it mm-hmm. and because there's yellow and green. Mm-hmm. So we chose blue.
Okay.
Blue tends to be a bit noisier.
Right.
Although it's, you know, the Kiers are pretty amazing right now. So.
Right.
It's not as bad as it used to be.
Sure.
But blue is great because it works with skin tones nicely and just because there's a lot of yellow in the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So green, you have to sort of, you know, when you're comping it,
yep.
change the color and put it back in and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
if you didn't see the before and after, sometimes it looks fine. But when you see before and after, it's like, oh, that doesn't look as good.
Right.
So blue, I love blue.
Okay.
Because it just does skin tones nicely.
And especially like blonde hair is actually a real pain in green.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's impossible. It's
yeah.
really difficult. And sometimes right. it is impossible.
Right.
Sometimes it doesn't look good or turn, it's the, you know, turns sort of magenta.
Right.
Weird. So, but the thing about green is that you can use tungsten lighting and you can use sort of more natural lighting
mm-hmm.
to it because it just, it's in that spectrum.
Right.
So, in terms of use,
mm-hmm. It's also like the least noisy one, right?
The least noisy.
Right.
But it's also the ugliest.
Yeah.
And people, one of the decisions on that big movie was it was blue because I chose it because of the golden factor.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone was very happy with that decision because they knew these giant stages, they were going to get sick if they looked at green all the time. So
right.
blue was a little more forgiving. It's like the sky color
sure.
and color of life and all that. So
yeah, right.
so blue is always, everyone's happy with blue. But sometimes it's just not as good because of lighting conditions and so
mm-hmm.
forth. So it's usually about color. Then you get into what the wardrobe is.
Sure.
If everyone's walking around in blue costumes, then
right.
it's not going to work.
Right.
And then there are degrees of blue, like there's the blue of your jeans, which
right.
is sort of a lighter color.
Right.
Well, that could work with blue. It'd be a little gnarly, but,
right.
you know, we can make it work. So you always have to sort of figure out where that line is because you're always going to get green or blue in some costume somewhere.
Yeah.
And then you figure that out. Oftentimes you have to work,
And you have to work at it with the – I was on a commercial once where we had to do all these extras in a background.
Right.
And so they just had a bunch of extras just walking in front of a screen that we were just going to roto out or whatever and put them as a background. And they just decided at the last minute, like, all right, well, let's just do this background extras for you guys. And they put up a blue screen and they shot it and everyone was wearing blue clothes.
Right.
It's like, I was like, no, that's not going to work.
Right.
So yeah, it's interesting. It's like, you got to remember, like, talk to the costume department.
Absolutely.
And make sure that they know that you're going to do a blue screen because it's going to be hard. And they're extras that can wear anything.
Right.
Just not blue.
Right. And sometimes there's a design, there's a reason that this garment needs to be blue.
Sure.
And you're against blue screen, and then you bring in green for that moment, or right. you've got to figure it out, or do tests if you're lucky enough to do tests.
Yeah.
And then do that blue against blue and just see how
the key's going to work. Yeah. Well, if you can, if you're lucky enough to be able to pull, someone in a blue costume with a blue screen, the good thing is that you don't get as much spill, right? You don't get as much. So that's but I also think that green lights evenly much better than blue.
Right.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's easier to just get a flat green back there than it is a flat blue.
And you get it with normal lighting, so you don't have to really worry about it as much.
Right. So, okay. So that's a good, back to my original question, that's a good reason for blue screen versus green screen when you're having actors, because they find it more pleasant environment to be in, right?
Right.
But what are some of the other factors? You know, for example, I was looking at the shot from Snowpiercer where they were walking in the train with all the aquariums and everything.
Right.
And it was completely green set, right? So how do you communicate to them how to act within that environment?
Well, in that case, we had a cage where this is a scene where they're walking in. Snowpiercer is about this train that people are on. Everything is on this train. And one of the train cars is an aquarium that at the end is a sushi bar.
Right.
That's just how it works. So we built a frame of where the glass was going to be. Mm-hmm. And that was important just to give everyone a reference of what that space was like.
Right.
It's very thin, and it was all green screen, so we painted that green as well.
But for them, it was reference, right?
It was reference just to give them a sense of space. Mm-hmm. And we had illustrations of what that was going to be like, and we showed them this is an aquarium, and there are fish here and there, and we had little areas where they could, sight lines, things that they could look at, and things like that. But usually that's enough. You've got to give them something. Mm-hmm. If there wasn't that cage that gave you a sense of enclosure, then it would just feel bigger than it was. It would get you a little lost.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, you could tell, let's say you'd had two or three actors in that scene and you didn't have that. Each of them may imagine something a little bit differently, and they're all going to act differently, right? And so it's going to be very confusing.
Right.
Yeah.
So you want to give enough clues.
Right.
And sometimes you don't have the actors there to ask, and you have to do it yourself. It's like, if I were acting, what would make me feel comfortable?
Right. Here.
And knowing that I know more about it than they do, or I'm more comfortable, go a little bit further.
Right.
So
Visual reference is important.
Visual reference is important, sight lines. And even like if this studio we're in now was just all blue screen and you weren't here, let's say it was just a virtual voice here, it would be nice to have something where your microphone is so I could be looking in the right direction.
So they have to – I dealt with a lot of CG characters, and those are always challenging, right? Because some of the challenges I have when you give me a scene and sight line, obviously, that's important. That's usually put on the animator to make sure that – or whoever's doing the layout to make sure that whatever the character they're talking to is set up in the direction that they're looking at,
right?
But then the other issue is they often light the shot for the person that's actually on the set,
right,
and not for the virtual character. And sometimes you'll use that light and this person's in shadow, looks wrong, and so you have to sort of invent lights that are not on set that match that and say, okay, pretend there was another light here, and would that affect the actor or whatever, so that they look like they're in the same spot?
That happens. That's usually a discussion when you talk with a DP, especially if it's like some high profile major movie star, and you have a close-up of them, and let's say they're riding in a car, and their light's going by, and it's sort of messy if you were really photographing them.
Right.
But then they do a nice edge light and a back light, and they make them look perfect.
Right.
But when you put them in the shot, it's wrong.
They look,
I did a movie, I'll leave unnamed at this point, where we had a major actor who was... That happened. It was a beautiful shot unto itself with blue, and they looked stunning.
Right.
But you put them in a car with the background, it was completely wrong. We had to actually build a CG face of them and actually do simulations of shadows going by them,
right,
and map that into their face and so forth, and make them look
like they're traveling through space.
Yeah, dirtier than what they were.
Yeah.
So that's something you're going to find, because there's a lot of pressure. You have like a major actor there, mm-hmm, who wants to look perfect.
Right.
And the scene dictates that they don't look so good.
Right.
The lighting is messy.
Right.
That's a hard discussion to have.
Right.
And you've really got to use your trust equity with the DP and understanding to have them actually, in a way, not do their job, or do their job, but not make them look as good as what they would be. So when you see dailies without that background,
right,
they're not going to look so good.
Right.
But when you put them in the background, they're going to look great.
Right. Yeah.
And so there's a lot of political aspects of that.
And how do you feel that DPs have changed over the years to be able to be more receptive to those types of choices?
Well, I think everyone, you know, for the most part, the DPs I've worked with have done visual effects films. They understand it. They are interested in it because they want their end result to look good.
Right.
And so there's a lot of respect for that process. Mm-hmm. And usually they want to have a conversation, mm-hmm, with you and understand what the end result is going to be and just do the best job possible.
Right.
And I find that there's a real openness to that. And because they're shooting, they're like the actors. They're shooting in a situation where it's just you and
nothing,
the void.
Right.
And it's like, well, where's the sun now? And it's like, what's happening up here? And
right,
they have to build that in. It's very difficult, really difficult for them to do. I have huge respect for the DPs because they're shooting now with less and less to work with.
Right.
It's not natural light. It's not like natural environments. Mm-hmm. It's artificial environments, mm-hmm, that they're shooting. They're shooting for something that's projected in the future.
Right.
So it's difficult. Really difficult.
Yeah. I mean, you could, I think the example you gave of driving shots, I mean, you can see it back from the 40s, right? Mm-hmm. Where it was just rear projection and these actors are perfectly lit in the background. It's just kind of, doesn't make any sense.
Right. Right.
You know, you rarely see that these days, right? We tend to do a much better job. Sometimes not as good on the comp side. I think a lot of times people get sloppy on car comps where you can just see something.
Right.
But I think people get a lot better in a lot of ways where they actually make things just prettier, right?
Right.
Like, and it feels more integrated. And you feel the sense that they're traveling through something.
Right.
Right.
There was something, I think Mike Seymour said this on one of his shows.
Yeah.
He was talking about you can judge the level of skill by window comps.
Oh, yeah.
And that really is, you can look at it and say, oh, they're really good.
Yep. And window comps are often just put in the background, like a monitor comp of some kind. But those are critical,
right?
Because it'll ruin a set really quickly.
Absolutely.
So window comps are very, very, and Mike's right about that. I 100% agree with him on that. Well, that's really cool. We're just at about an hour, but I really want to sort of think about a little bit about some of the things you've mentioned, because I think people could learn a lot from this. Mm-hmm. Do you think that? Based on all the things that you've done, we could help the visual effects industry get a greater respect for the kind of work that we do overall. How do you think that could happen? Because right now, I think a lot of people are kind of coming down on visual effects, coming down on computer graphics, and saying, "Oh, it was so much better when it was all done real or miniatures or done for." Where do you think that disparaging comes from?
Well, it's interesting. I sense that too sometimes, and a lot of it is glossed over hindsight sometimes.
Okay.
Because it's a combination. I mean, you really want to have some real elements if you can get them, mm-hmm, and then blend those in with the artificial elements, let's say. And it's always usually the best of both worlds when you can do that. I have this where it's like, well, we have to build it real because it'll just look better.
Right.
And oftentimes you end up replacing the whole thing,
mm-hmm,
because you can't get the subtlety, levels of subtlety that you can do.
Sure.
So it's, it's not really, I mean, you're not going to get respect by saying, no, you're wrong.
Sure.
You're going to get respect by just having a conversation about it. It's an interesting thing you talk about because people say, oh, it's all just CG and it doesn't really matter.
Right.
But it could be a great film and wonderful animation and all this, and it's just sort of a catch-all term. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to some directors who say, forget CG, I'm going to do it all. We're going to go old school. We're going to do it models on broomsticks, and it's going to be great.
Right.
Like it was in the old days. And it's like, well, it's going to look like something on a broomstick. I mean,
right.
That's what it's going to be. And,
right.
And the visual appetite, it's in conflict with sort of what the masses are saying.
But people eat it up right now in the press. They almost do it just for the marketing of it.
Right.
Like they'll go through the hardship of making it physically real, not because it's better for the movie or because it's easier. They're doing it because they think people will think it's better if we do that.
Right. And if the audience says, oh, it's CG, then if you say, oh, that actor really jumped off of that giant building, mm-hmm. and it's the real guy,
right?
You know, and they really did it because I read an article that said he really did fall 500 feet into a bag that was 6 feet wide.
Right.
And that's thrilling and that's exciting, but it really wasn't the case at all.
Right.
So there's a lot of this misinformation that goes on mm-hmm. with it. A lot of it's the marketing, and there are a lot of famous examples of, mm-hmm. of recent movies where mm-hmm. he said there were no effects at all, but there were thousands and thousands of them.
I mean, I think that was the big thing with Mad Max. That's the best example we have. Everyone's like, oh, it was all practical. It's like, actually, about 2,000 shots on CG.
And brilliant effects that Dan Oliver did, and also, but special effects, but also brilliant visual effects, too.
The beauty of it is that it all worked together.
It worked together.
Right.
And that was a great example of the combination.
Yeah.
So it's like it's hard to get around that buzzword of like, oh, it's just CG.
Yeah.
Because it usually is a combination of all those. It's just not understanding mm-hmm. that. I guess the only way to gain respect is just to educate, you know, willing to listen.
Because I was thinking about it the way you were describing some things and some of the things you have on set and how people, you know, like you used the example of, you know, a teeny little piece of blue screen and everyone stops.
Right.
Performing the way they normally perform.
Right.
Do you think that educating people on set from the actors to the DPs and everything, or creating like a handbook or a small tutorial of like understanding how this is going to work could help everyone in the long run?
I don't know if it's a handbook because no one's going to read it.
Sure.
But I think it's
maybe a video series.
It's conversations. I mean, it's just your relationship of yourself and the actors, and usually I find there's a lot of interest in what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
There's from actors sometimes there's a resistance to being scanned because you're taking their soul and then they're going to own it, and rightfully so.
Yeah.
There's that concern of where that line blurs.
Mm-hmm.
So. I think some of it is fear too.
Sure.
It's like just maybe from the industry side, like thinking that we're taking over or everything's going to be CG, everything will just be an animated film at one point.
Yeah.
And or we'll bring an actor here and take a few snapshots and all of a sudden we'll say goodbye and then we own them.
Right.
And we'll recreate them forever.
Sure.
Something like that. So there's that side, but really your true question, I think, was just in terms of fully CG films, if people have to disguise the fact that there really is CG mm-hmm. or the respect that people have for it rather than saying, oh, it's just CG versus meaning that you can do anything with the push of a button, which is absolutely not the case.
No.
So the only way to gain true respect, I mean, is through education anyway. And that's harder than any kind of campaign.
Right.
But I find that you may hear that, but people rely on this work so much now mm-hmm. that there's no way out of it.
No.
There's no way out of it.
And a lot of times people don't realize how much CG they're even looking at.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And thousands of shots sometimes mm-hmm. where it doesn't even look like a visual effects film.
Right.
And so... Yeah, I mean, I think it's this sort of underground thing. It's like where when you get into, if you're really doing it, you're really on the set, mm-hmm. you're really working with the people who are actually making the movies, there's a lot of respect for what you do. Mm-hmm. And because, first of all, of just the artistry, but also because of the need
sure.
to know that, I mean, stunt people, the best stunt people are huge proponents of visual effects because
absolutely.
You save their life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know stunt guys, yeah, I really do want to jump off that building because I can do it, you know.
Right.
But then they say, well, you may die. And right. it's like, okay, so I'll just do the first part. But mm. you need the practical, stunts are a good example because
okay.
you need those moments with real people to set up some of the big shots, let's say, that are impossible to do.
Right.
But they make the setup and the work that they do mm-hmm. More plausible.
Right.
And they make that work. So it's a real handoff between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that you're right. I think it's happening more now where people are taking real reference of stunts, et cetera, because, you know, look, 10, 15 years ago, you'll see a lot of CG doubles that were moving in a very unnatural way,
right,
you know?
Right.
And nowadays you'll see them and like, you don't know which, when there's a CG person in there. In fact, there often is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of handoffs.
Yeah. Yep. And that's a great skill too, you know?
Yep.
So make it look exactly like that. I love those things. When I was on the box, just making my CG character look exactly like the previous frame of the live action
right, right.
person and seeing how that blend happens with the compositing, and it's really cool.
And it's critical. On usually stunts, like you do them, sometimes they work perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you only have two shots. Let's say they can do it once, twice,
right.
sometimes once.
Right.
And the first part's great. The second part fell apart.
Right.
And then you take it over and make it work.
Right.
And it makes them look great.
Yeah.
So they love that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly. Well, this has been a fabulous conversation. Thanks so much for coming by. This is great.
Thank you so much.
So you're thinking about doing a podcast yourself?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay.
I'd love to because you get to talk to people and
oh, yeah. It's
fun.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. I've done over 100 episodes
wow.
and it's been great. So I highly recommend it. It's very therapeutic.
Yeah, yeah.
So
we have a great studio here to have it in.
Yeah,
you're well
it's
set
nice.
Up.
It's yeah. We just put some great stuff up, and it's kind of cool. So it works out well for me here.
Great,
cool. Well, thanks so much for doing this.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.